Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Dr. Lara Greaves this morning. Kia ora, Lara. How are you going?
Morning. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for being our last one of the year as well. We've had a whole year of big politics and changes going on here in Aotearoa and in the world, and COVID's been a big proponent of a lot of that. Still plenty going on in that space right now, of course, with Aucklanders being able to leave the city and folks being able to come into Auckland as well as of just a day ago, basically. We have seen, obviously, a lot of contentious debate around this, particularly heading into spaces like Northland, where the vaccination rate is still very low. There are iwi and police checkpoints set up at the moment, and there are still a lot of strong messages coming out from iwi up north saying, please don't come here. What do you think we're going to see over summer when it comes to negotiating that difficult relationship between the Crown management of that and iwi management of that space?
Well, I think it's reflective overall of the government's failure to protect Māori through the pandemic and uphold Te Tiriti o Waitangi. But other than that, like taking all of that out of it, I think it now comes down to people's individual personal political choice and their moral and ethical choice as to what they're going to get up to over summer. Like, iwi have clearly said all around the country that, like, we don't want you there, even if you're from there, even if that's where you fuck a papa to, that they're not necessarily, they don't necessarily want you back there. So it's really a matter of thinking about and your personal priorities, where, I don't know, where people's family situations are, what the alternatives are, and all those sorts of things. But like a group headed by Dion O'Neill at the University of Auckland set out like a few sort of guidelines where people can individually do that more safely if they need to or do choose to travel. And it's just things like limiting your contact, like don't get drunk at the work Christmas party and kiss everyone right before you go to Northland.
Yeah.
Like, go and get a test even though you're double vaccinated and that sort of thing. Just being really sensible and respectful. But I think ultimately it's going to come down to people's personal individual choice and weighing up those priorities, and it's going to be ideological and political. It's going to be more like left-wing people are going to go, no, I'll just stay in Auckland for summer. That's what it's going to come down to. And it's a shame that it's coming down to this, but unfortunately the political reality is things always come down to this.
Now, speaking of those inequities in the vaccination rollout, we've got a sort of second phase, or I don't know what phase we're up to now, but a new phase in the vaccination plan happening early next year, and that is vaccinating tamariki, which is going to pose different challenges. It's also something that I think a lot of people are very anxious to happen quickly. What's your thoughts about how we should see this happen, because it's, you know, quite a big step for protecting another large part of the population?
Yeah, I think it's like really important in all of these conversations to really think about the high proportion of children that are Māori. It's like in the high 20%, and that's really, like, I think quite necessary to take into account when we're talking about all of this, because we know from pretty much like every other vaccine that Māori are less vaccinated. And so we obviously, it's very clear again when you're sitting there like preemptively looking at plans going forward, where you have all of those priors, all of those previous knowledge, that the vaccine rollout for tamariki Māori is going to be slower, and that there's going to need to be a concerted effort in like a whānau based approach and a school based approach and all of that. Because fundamentally, like, it's really that the vaccinating 5 to 11 year olds, while they tend to have a mild version of the disease, is that it's like the population spread, and it's all about that population spread. And if we look at Māori and Pacifica living in like multiple generational households and having greater contact, greater social contact with others and people who do have those like compounding comorbidities and more in contact with people with substandard housing and so on, that's really vital for spread. And of course, so there's the concerns around children having long COVID and people having that as a long-term disability as well. So this is like one of those fundamental political issues in the coming year for people to get right. We're seeing from survey data that about a quarter of parents are reluctant in surveys, and of course Māori are underrepresented in surveys as well. So, and the kind of people who are not going to get vaccinated and have their kids vaccinated are also underrepresented in those. So this is going to be like a really crucial thing to get right. It's obviously a very complex problem, and like a whole bunch of compounding inequities are going to be at play.
Is it fair, do you think, to suggest that it could be a little bit harder in some spaces to have this conversation? Because I guess when it comes to people choosing to have their own, person vaccinated, it feels a little bit different for some parents maybe getting their kids vaccinated. I know that for a lot of people it's just a no-brainer. They want their kids to be protected. That's the best way to do it. But there are some maybe trickier conversations which we see in wider and non-COVID vaccination scenarios. What would you like to see in terms of overcoming some of those potential barriers to getting people protected?
Well, I think one of the most fundamental issues there, right, is that the group that is least vaccinated are like Māori in their 20s and then younger, sort of young Māori under 40, and those are the parents of the kids that we're now seeking to vaccinate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's going to be a real issue when a lot of people in that age bracket, that ethnicity bracket, have not been vaccinated already themselves.
Mm.
And so now you're turning around and going, oh, well, bring the tamariki. And that's just not logical that that's going to flow on, right? So then that comes back to those issues with that longer exposure to misinformation for young Māori, from Māori populations, and goes back to all of those issues again. I imagine that the sort of misinformation, disinformation is going to pop up a lot over the next year, over the next couple of years, and I imagine those groups are going to start targeting parents.
Yeah, it's not a very inspiring time, is it, when you jump online and see those rabbit holes kind of open up? But yeah, hopefully we can see some positive moves in that space. And as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of different ways we should be approaching doing that. But let's talk about some non-COVID stuff, because there's been some other big changes happening in the political sphere recently, particularly the National Party. They have had quite a tumultuous couple of years, and they've got new leaders again. We've got Christopher Luxon, and we have also got Nicola Willis as the deputy leader. Now, what's your thoughts about the first kind of week and a bit that we've seen of this new team, the new, I guess, rebrand of the National Party? How does it sit with you at the moment in terms of the way the National Party's been moving in the last wee while?
I'm really kind of just generally quite happy. This is a positive thing for me, because I think for everyone, we want to have strong, effective opposition, right? We want to have opposition that's going after the government on various things, when we're not all distracted on this person said this thing happened, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's really important for New Zealand generally. I'm also quite happy for their supporters and their members and their staffers and all of that, because it really does seem that Luxon and Willis have gone, okay, we're turning the page now, we're moving forward, this is us as a group, now we're moving forward, let's go further, let's do something different. I do think there's still a lot of residual issues with their board and their external sort of governance structures that they need to sort out. I think that that's probably going to come to a head next year for the party. But I think generally this is a positive step just for politics in general, to move away from Collins, who was using a lot of divisive and using a lot of marginalised groups in her rhetoric. We saw that with her pōpō. We saw this with the Jackie Dean and all of the sort of Me Too type rhetoric that she drew on to attack bridges. And we saw this around conversion therapy. So I think that ultimately this is an overall positive move for everyone.
There has been some conversation, I guess, around Christopher Luxon's religion and that being a major part of his life. He said, you know, that's not going to be part of his politics, that's his personal life. But we've seen in the past, you know, that he's voted against things like abortion and against the safe space zone outside hospitals. What do you think we might see from that space? Is that something that's perhaps concerning, or is that something that you think is possible to be separated from his leadership?
Now, so the big issue for National is National need to win back those centre voters, the types that went to Labor. And we know from the election study that they tend to be women at higher rates, younger people at higher rates, and so on. So at the moment, what we've seen in the first poll from Courier and the Taxpayers Union is that National have gone up a bit, but they've been stealing from ACT. But National strategy really needs to be in winning back that middle. And so I think that that's where people often associate, obviously, like abortion and women and women's voting. But it's not clear that with those kind of, it's really like 5% of people that are sitting in that centre, like how many of them, how high that, say, abortion is on their issue priorities.
Mm.
But I mean, for people on the left, like that's an absolutely crucial thing, and I think a lot of people on the left would be concerned about a Prime Minister holding those views and holding those views publicly. So it's really about, like, strategically in terms of, like, party politics, it's about winning back those few percent of people in the middle that went to Labour because of their great COVID response. And that's really what it's going to come down to. I think that the media and just generally, and I think that these are legitimate questions of a prime minister as to where they sit on kind of crucial social issues of our time. But I think that and we will see a lot of focus on that in the coming year, I think particularly around the conversion practices bill, which is still going through. I think it comes back from Select Committee in February, March. So that's when we're going to see more of this debate as to whether Luxon makes the caucus all vote as one, or whether they can do conscience kind of free votes. So that's going to be, I think, a continued issue over this next year as the media generally tackled the question as to whether someone of faith, a social conservative, can be an effective prime minister.
And just before we let you go as well, I did want to ask you thoughts about something that I have seen a lot of the left and left media speculating on, which was Dr. Shane Reti and whether he ever had a chance or should have had a chance to be in the contention for the leadership there. That seems to be something that has come quite vocally from left-wing media. Do you think that was something that was ever possible to happen in that space? Why didn't it happen? What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I also, I think Dr. Shane Reti would have been a great candidate, like, just on the experience. I mean, I was reading his profile, you know, he's 17 years as a rural GP in Northland, was an assistant professor at Harvard, and then somehow was some type of registered accountant as well. I was like, what? So obviously he was quite qualified, but just didn't have that kind of persona that people associate with leadership. And that, it wasn't really clear whether he wanted it either as well within that. So I think that's where people were looking at his experience and going, well, why not put him in, especially given that it's a pandemic and that's where a lot of his expertise lies. So that seemed like a logical choice to a lot of people. And again, if the left are kind of liking him, then maybe that does indicate that people in the centre of New Zealand politics would be more likely to vote for National if he were the leader. But it all comes down to what Professor Raymond Miller called the presidentialisation of New Zealand politics, that now it's viewed as this like contest of leaders, contest of presidential style figures, and the kind of speaking style of Dr. Shane Reti meant that people counted him out quite instantly rather than thinking of him as a performer. And I think that's that fundamental question that we have to go back to in our politics and our leadership and the way that our system is structured as to whether we kind of want to be that way, because that produces a certain type of leader.
Yeah.
And will continue to produce a certain type of leader over the years, over the huge challenges that we're facing in the future.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Dr. Lara Greaves, and for all your contributions across the year. It's been really excellent to have you on the show, so thank you very much for being part of it. Have a wonderful Christmas, and we will talk to you again in January.
You're welcome. I hope everyone gets a great break.
Yeah, I think we all deserve it. Kia ora. See you later.
Kia ora.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with Dr.